dirty facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Kale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to the Kale Clark Show, and happy, happy anniversary to Kale and his wife, Trisha. He has a day off today. So if you think of it, please remember Kale's family in your prayers and gratitude for their example and many, many more blessed years ahead. Praying for the intercession of the Holy Family and Saint Joseph. Pray for Kale. And in fact, 1 week from today, we will be coming up on March 19th. I'm just looking at the calendar right here. March 19th, we celebrate the feast of St. Joseph. St. Joseph the Worker, Joseph most strong, pillar of families, hope of the sick, terror of demons. Those are just some of the titles, of course, of St. Joseph. And today on the program, we will hear stories, I think, that call to mind his patronage under some of those titles, from a father surviving a catastrophic plane crash in the mountains, unbelievable story, to then a leading expert in security and law enforcement ethics, rooting out public corruption. Really fascinating. We have quite a power-packed hour for you, so looking forward to jumping in. It's Brooke Taylor with you. How are you? How is your week going? I hope you're having a blessed day. I'm coming to you from my studio in Ohio, and the weather is so beautiful. It snowed a little bit on Sunday. Today it's like 65. And I feel like, as we are in this period of Lent, that is really the natural world reminding us of this cosmic drama. We heard that on Sunday with the readings, our Lord healing the man born blind. And in Ephesians, St. Paul reminding us we are children of the light. So I love that, you know, when there is this beauty in creation that mimics the resurrection as we get closer. So depending on where you are, of course, in the country or in the world, but it's such a beautiful thing and it's glorious. And if today hasn't been a very good day, well, then you're in the right place, because we have an incredible story about miracles, what a miracle life really is. Erin Franco is a former model. Today she's a speaker, writer, wife, mother of six, and she and her husband have a astounding story, just touching on marriage at the top of the show with Kale's anniversary, considering what it means to live your vows for better or worse in sickness and in health. And they have quite a testimony. Looking forward to hearing from Erin about their witness. Joining us now from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, is Erin Franco. Welcome to the show. Hi, Erin.
Hi there. It's such a pleasure to be here tonight.
You too. It's good to talk to you. Finally, I've read your story. I've followed your journey. And for those that maybe are just for the first time getting to know you, just so many fascinating aspects about your life. But that miracle plane crash, survival, surrender, trust, all of that. Can you maybe just give us a little bit of a life snapshot? I know that's a big question, but just a review maybe.
Sure. Yeah. So I am in Louisiana in the southern United States. We have six kids. Michael and I have been married for 15 years. And yeah, over the course of my life and my marriage, I've really been invited by the Lord to trust. That's really the theme of what I write about and speak about, to trust in ordinary things, everyday life, and also in some pretty extraordinary things as well. And yes, I did start off life with a kick after high school. I spent some time in New York as a model, and had a pretty powerful experience where the Lord just kind of broke through all of the glamour and all of the temptation and said, I made you for more than this. And so I quit and I went home and almost immediately met my future husband, who's a wonderful guy. And we started on the roller coaster that is every marriage and every life. And it's been a beautiful 15 years so far.
Well, I want to ask you about the modeling, because it is really fascinating and I think relatable of that time period where we're just starting out and we're chasing all the things that we believe will bring us happiness, what that's going to look like. Of course, you have many gifts, beauty, grace, you had talent in that regard. Were you practicing your faith? Had you gone there as a strong Catholic and then were able to see, or did something shake you? What was that like to make you realize this was not where God was calling you?
Right. Well, I'm a cradle Catholic. It's a very Catholic area of the world here in South Louisiana. But I really don't think I really had been tested in my faith. And when I went up to New York and the things I saw, the things I went through and experienced really made me kind of hold up, this is the world, and this is what the world is saying a woman is and what a woman is for and what a powerful woman looks like. And then this, on the other hand, I remember one day I actually found my way into a church. I hadn't been going to mass, but I found my way into the church, and it's like the Lord held up Our Lady to me, on the other hand, mm-hmm. so that I could just see both at the same time. And he said, this is how I treat women. This is what I made women for, to be honored and respected, to bring life into the world, and also to be safe in my arms and in my heart. And that was something I really needed to hear at the time. And I think that was definitely the start of like a reversion to my, I was always a great mm-hmm. kid, but it was a reversion to my faith. And I 100% ended up quitting modeling, went back, went to college, and just jumped in to everything I could on campus that was Catholic, showed up by myself to things. I said, I want to be part of something that treats women this way, that has a plan and a hope for my future that the Lord gives all of us. I'm grateful for it in that regard, that I went 100% right back the other way from New York City back to my faith.
Yes, and like a signal grace where you were able to be led mm-hmm. by the beauty of Our Lady, the authentic femininity, her virtue, right. and be able to contrast those two lives so specifically, and then really model that, live that out then, your vocation as wife and mother. So it sounds like when you met your husband, he too was Catholic, and then you just began through the sacrament of matrimony, your marriage and family, and that kind of was how the last many years have gone.
Right. Yeah. Michael has his own story of actually coming back to his faith right before he met me. It's the Lord's timing. But yeah, we met and we said, we are going to just rock out this marriage thing. We're going to have the best, most holy Catholic marriage ever. And so we had all these high hopes and high ideals going into marriage. And just like everybody else, we've been just navigating real life and figuring out where all of those beautiful ideals and ideas actually like hit everyday life, like where that middle is and where the Lord is in that.
Well, and that sounds like you faithfully then endeavored to do that until this curveball. And so it's kind of neat because you are already faithful, trusting, locked in. I know you have some other things in there as well, including a chainsaw accident, which I don't mean to laugh about. It's not funny at all, but I guess maybe we should touch on that. It's kind of a cryptic tease, but you talk about trust a lot in your story. So that definitely comes into play.
Right. Well, you know, we actually laugh. I knew when I married Michael that I was never going to be bored. And I certainly have not. He's had several pretty severe injuries and accidents. And we've had lots of different jobs and different things that we've been through. But yes, actually, I think, you know, you always think, oh, this is my testimony, this thing that I just went through. And sometimes that is it. And then sometimes a plane crash happens, which is what happened to us a few years ago. In 2022, in the summer, Michael was turning 40 years old. And a friend of ours, an old friend who is a pilot, invited him for his 40th birthday to go to a trip to North Carolina. They were going to fly up there and they had kind of a fun route planned. We had some friends up there that they were going to be visiting. And to make a long story short, when they were up there, something happened with the plane. The second day that they were there, they were flying through the mountains. And they actually had another friend of ours who had jumped in the plane at the last minute said, hey, can I ride with y'all this afternoon? So there were three men in the plane. And as they were going through the mountains, about 45 minutes south of Asheville, something happened. They lost control of the plane. Everything stopped working and they crashed into a thickly wooded area. And it's just it's definitely one of those phone calls that you're like, you know, you never want to get you. It's very surreal when you get it. But yeah, there are just, I don't even know where to start. There are so many.
Oh, uh-huh. quick, two quick questions. I'm sorry, Erin. Is number one, another kind of context here is you were also pretty pregnant at the time, right? And then the location that it crashed, did I read correctly that it was almost right near a chapel in the mountains?
Yes. Yes, I was 6 months pregnant, or I think maybe 5 months pregnant at the time of the crash that summer with our sixth child. And yes, there are so, it's hard to talk about something like this because in our, there are just so many phenomenal miracles that occurred. But the plane crashed in a thickly wooded area, but absolutely guided by heaven, because they ended up crashing in this very remote outdoor chapel used by the summer camp that they actually crashed on the summer camp's property, like right on the edge of the property. It's a Christian summer camp owned by a very faithful Catholic family. And so they had to just enter just right to go through the trees. This thick canopy only had a little break in it. They land upside down completely. The plane's broken in half. Everything's broken off the plane in front of the altar, in front of a cross. And all three men survived ultimately. None of them have brain damage. All of them are able to walk and provide for their families again. And 2 years later, nearly now, are doing wonderful. And this this kind of crash, this situation, one of the investigators told us, there's usually only a 1% chance of survival, that anyone would survive this. So it's just truly, truly a miracle to ponder our whole lives, really, about what the Lord was doing, what, you know, why he permitted this, and what his plans are for these three wonderful, faithful guys.
Yeah, as you said, there's so many points and parts. First of all, that everyone survived, and it was, it sounds like a Cessna. It was a small private plane.
It was a rented, like I think it was 1972 or 1973 Cessna. So a very small plane. And when I actually went and touched it later on, we actually have a piece of it here at our house.
Wow.
That we caught. And I told Michael, if I would have seen this and touched it and seen that it's literally like a tin can before the trip, I don't know if you actually would have gone on this trip. It's just, it blows my mind that any of them could have survived.
Yeah.
Because it just looks like crumpled wreckage that they crawled out of.
And even though they did survive, I know Michael had very significant injuries and obviously a long recovery. And one note about your story, I actually just thought about it today when I was reading the gospel, because today's reading is Jesus healing the official's son. And there's a moment in the story where we read the fever left him yesterday about 1 p.m. And the father realized, I'm reading it here, just at that time, Jesus had said to him, your son will live. And he and his whole household came to believe. Now, this was the second sign Jesus did when he came to Galilee from Judea. So he realizes the timing of it. When Jesus said, your son will live, at that moment, the fever left him. And I know for your husband, wasn't there a similar experience where Michael's in the hospital, I think going in at some point to cardiac distress, and this realization that almost at the same time he was stabilized, you realized at that very moment there was a group praying the rosary gathered, lifting up your family?
Yes. Yes. We had actually planned the weekend after the accident, we were going to host a 40th birthday party, big bash at our house. And a lot of our friends after the accident decided to still meet up instead of going to the party and just pray the rosary for our family and for Michael. That very same afternoon, Michael experienced a bad reaction to a medication and went into just cardiac distress, just kind of fainted in my arms and left me, and I got pushed back. The doctors and nurses all came in and they were trying to figure out what was going on and bring him back. And it feels like a lifetime when you're actually there, but it was about maybe 10 or 15 minutes. And that whole time I stepped back and I just was enveloped with this incredible calm and incredible presence of mind. And I know now that it was Our Lady. She was just standing there holding me, hugging me, right there with me. And I just told the Lord, you know, you really could have had my husband survive a plane crash and then he could die right here. He's got a complicated medical situation. You could take him now. And you know what? If that is his story and if that is your will, I'm going to trust you. If this baby in me and if our other five children grow up without their dad, I'm going to trust that you still have a beautiful plan for our lives. And I just want you to know I give him back to you, if that's what you will. And all of that in a moment, I don't know if I even said all of those words, but you know, in prayer, sometimes it's just what you mean and
yes.
just, you don't need words. And when I found out later that afternoon that we had all those people praying the rosary right at that time, I knew that wasn't me. I knew that that was a grace from Our Lady to help me, like she gave Jesus to the Lord and had kept her hands open. That's what she did for me. And at the same time, actually, also, Michael has a beautiful experience. He says he'll tell it way better than I do. But he actually felt the Lord come and call him back and say, Michael, I still have work for you to do. So it's time to go back to your wife and your family. So it really just a powerful, powerful story for our family and witness of the power of the rosary and just the mysteries of God.
Yeah, mystery. There it is. I mean, it's so true. And embracing it, your abandonment, your trust, your peace. And is there a message, a lesson that you've learned through the plane crash, the aftermath, about abandonment to God's will and what that looks like on a daily basis? Because even in the moment you say, okay, I feel strong, there then are other moments where there's desolation or there is isolation or depression. Anything that you learned that you could maybe impart about that and surrender trust?
Absolutely. I'd say God rides straight with crooked lines. And he had permitted some suffering in my life long before the plane crash, multiple things that I learned that lesson. And so that was very helpful to have that preparatory experience and suffering before the plane crash. I've also learned that the hardest year of your life can end up being a year of favor. You just have to give it some time and look back, and sometimes you have to say, Lord, I believe that in 5 years, in 1 year, I'm going to look back and I'm going to see you are doing something beautiful with all of this.
I just wrote that down. The hardest year of your life can be a year of favor. Amen. And as we approach the resurrection, that is the truth and the paradox of the cross. And I know that we're almost out of time, but I also wanted to ask you about the national election. Basically, you have been appointed, you and your husband, Michael, to the U.S. National Couple for the English-speaking domestic church, a movement apostolate. It seems rightly so, your testimony and your everyday witness. But for those that might not know what that ministry is or the movement, can you give us the scoop on that?
Sure, definitely. Mike and I really have had some struggles in our marriage earlier on, and that's a whole another beautiful story, but the Lord brought us to a Polish marriage movement called Domestic Church that came up in the 1960s in communist-occupied Poland. Mm-hmm. And it's a small group community. It's praying with your spouse every day, working on your own prayer life somehow every day. It's a marriage movement that we have been involved in for about 10 years, and we were elected to lead the English speakers in the U.S. Last year. So we're doing that and are busy with that for the next few years. It's been such a godsend in another way that the Lord really provided through the plane crash, through all those muscles of prayer and trust and going back to scripture every day, praying together every day, or working toward that all these years. So I'm so grateful.
And we are, just the restoration, the strengthening of marriages is so needed. So many couples are hurting and struggling, and we know that's part of life, but just to be able to be rooted in the sacraments, the graces of the church, and learning things. You know, a lot of times we have to trust our Lord's, all the time, to be seeking his Sacred Heart to teach us because we might not have had good models or examples or know ourselves. And it's such a beautiful thing to see and to be a part of the domestic church movement. And if we want to learn more and really get in touch with you, I know you have a blog. You love to write. You're a beautiful writer. Could you tell us how to connect with you?
Yes. It's erinfranco.com.
Okay, that's easy. E-R-I-N, right? F-R-A-N-C-O.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much. God bless you. God bless your husband and your family. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're so welcome. God bless you as well.
Thanks, Erin. St. Joseph, pray for us too. And 1 week from today, March 19th, is the Feast of St. Joseph, St. Joseph the Worker. So we talked about, at the top of the show, Pillar of Families, Hope of the Sick. And I think that certainly applies to Michael Franco, the story we just heard, the survivor of a plane crash and a beautiful model for his own family. Erin, thank you again. And Blessed Mother, as you strive in the vocation to be a humble handmaid, I know that's a big part of the ministry there as well. So erinfranco.com, the blog. And another title, speaking of St. Joseph, is Terror of Demons, one of my favorite titles. And I think that ties in perfectly to our next guest. He is a graduate of Franciscan University in Steubenville, former FBI agent, public corruption expert, and today he is a nonpartisan law enforcement analyst. His name is Jeff Kortze. He's with us, and he will be next joining us for the rest of the hour here on The Cale Clark Show. It's Brooke Taylor in for Cale today, back in a moment here on Relevant Radio and the app. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Cale Clark. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. They're a pro-life phone company, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to Relevant Radio or another pro-life charity of your choice. For a limited time, new customers who mention offer code Relevant Radio get a free phone with free activation and free shipping. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com.
This is The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Cale has a day off today, and it is actually his wedding anniversary, so please do say a prayer for Cale and his beautiful bride today, Trish, and their daughter, Michaela. Happy to fill in for him today. It's Brooke Taylor. Always glad to be with you, and thank you for being here. We have a fantastic rest of the hour. Jeff Kortze joins me. He is a grad of Franciscan University in Steubenville, the author also of the book Public Corruption in the United States, Analysis of a Destructive Phenomenon, and the guy to write the book. As you will hear, he is a decorated officer, federal officer. His career includes everything from working as an anti-fraud examiner in the financial sector to a special agent on the security detail of the United States Speaker of the House, FBI agent. Looking forward to our conversation. So much to cover in the time that we have. Jeff Kortze, happy to have you here. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you so much, Brooke. I'm grateful to be here. Love the opportunity. Thank you.
Yes, and thank you for what you do. And I know we'll get into those details. We've got lots to cover. So just there in the intro, covering a bit of your expertise, your history and resume. But just for context, I think it would be neat to highlight some of the specifics. So can you take us into some of your roles? We know that you graduated from Franciscan and then maybe from there, because it's really diverse and pretty fantastic.
Yeah, no problem at all. Yes, I graduated from Franciscan University of Steubenville. Started out in the private sector, financial services specifically. Worked for a mutual fund company. Did that for a short spell. And, you know, figured in the post 9/11 environment, I was still young enough and single enough to you know, welcome a new challenge and try something different. So I pursued something that had been on my mind for a long time, and that was law enforcement. Starting my law enforcement career out with the United States Capitol Police in Washington, D.C., where I spent a few years on the former Speaker of the House, Denny Hastert's security detail. After a few years on his detail, I accepted a role with the FBI. My first office was in New Orleans, where I worked public corruption, and it was a fabulous place to cut my teeth in working public corruption investigations. I was on the SWAT team down there as well. Wow. Eventually took a transfer to Tucson, Arizona, where I worked Southwest border violence. So that included bajadores and sicarios. So that's a home invasion crews and hitmen, cartel hitmen. More of the violent focus at the Southwest border. Eventually took a promotion to FBI headquarters in the public corruption unit. Was there for about 2 years, 10 months out of the 2 years, I was the acting chief of the public corruption unit. Public corruption is the FBI's number one criminal priority program, so it was a unique opportunity to kind of see how the sausage is made, so to speak. I went back to the field, to Tucson, then took another transfer to San Francisco and finished out my my time with the Bureau there. Left the Bureau a few years back and transitioned to the private sector again, working in risk management. But I, you know, still keep my foot, in my toe dipped in the water.
Yeah.
Of law enforcement, I do some analysis. I'm a senior lecturer at the International Anti-Corruption Academy in Vienna, Austria. Associate at the Rutgers Institute on Anti-Corruption Studies, and I'm an adjunct professor at the old Franciscan University. They have a criminal justice program there now, and I teach a corruption in the justice system course.
That's fantastic. Boy, do we need it. And they do, I must say, have a fantastic program there. And so it's good to hear that, and I'm sure for you, fulfilling as well and encouraging. And boy, what you just brought us through, meandering all these fascinating aspects, definitely touching on the border violence. I want to go back to that. But with your focus for so many years on public corruption, I guess maybe that's a starting point of, it just seems like a simple question, but what is the definition of public corruption? And I get, for an example, like, even that thin line between lobbying and bribery, sometimes yeah. it's very hard to tell. So maybe the simple definition of what is public corruption, how can we spot and identify it as just civilians?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And, you know, you said it seems rather simple, but it's not. It is a complex question. It is difficult. And let me give you an example. I think generally speaking, there are three accepted definitions for corruption by society in general. And, you know, starting with the most common or the most popular one is, you know, a lot of people define corruption as my enemy, my political enemy. If I'm on the left, it's everyone on the right's corrupt. If I'm on the right, everyone on the left is corrupt. They don't even really know what that means. They just, they know they feel that way, right? Yeah. So that's probably the most accepted form or definition of the word. Second to that would be anything unethical. A lot of people consider anything unethical to be corrupt. From my perspective in the FBI, when I was working with the FBI, we focused on the third, which is the least really understood definition, and that is the what criminal corruption is. And public corruption, to give you that definition, is the abuse of one's government position for personal gain. Typically, that'll manifest itself in the form of bribery, extortion, embezzlement. But that's the short version of it. It's easier to define than it is to identify. And that's, I guess, part of why I wrote the book, was to be able to provide a resource for people to understand what corruption looks like, what it smells like, how to identify it when they run into it, and then what to do with it, and why it matters, you know, the impact of it.
Boy, that's for sure. And I think, too, people, I'm just generalizing, but it seems to me more and more feel like so often corruption comes from the inside. It's this inner rot. And there, that leads to the question of what to do about it. You know, I mean, even, and I don't want to get in, I'm just looking at the headlines and I'm simply reporting here, but I'm just giving an example just today, sure, seeing the headlines of the whistleblower at Boeing. And then, you know, he winds up deceased and there's some questions about that. I'm not, casting any aspersions. I'm just simply reporting that. So then people have questions. That's where conspiracy begins. And we do live in a time where there are a lot of psyops and paranoia and, you know, things that are very difficult to get to the root of it. So how do we know, especially as a general civilian, because it seems like things are so convoluted?
They are. They are convoluted. And, you know, as
by design,
time goes
I'm sure.
on, I'm sorry?
By design, I'm sure.
Well, you know, it feels that way. And increasingly so, because technology being what it is, the internet being what it is, some of the typical strategies that are used to confuse are made easier because of the internet and social media. Information can flow much faster now. You know, a successful misinformation campaign doesn't require somebody to believe something that's not true. It could be successful by just making the truth unidentifiable, impossible to find.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we run into a lot. You know, our brains kind of can jump on stories here and there based on things we see in our social media circles, where we kind of find ourselves in these echo chambers where we surround ourselves with like-minded people, restating and regurgitating stories that may or may not even be true.
Well, and
but
where I think
hard to differentiate between the truth and the not true.
And, you know, that's something all the time, custody of our mind. And as Catholics, there is the aspect of virtue, objective truth, moral law, for example, ethics. And that's where you have this training, this expertise and formation in. And we are living in, as we were talking about, very confusing times with deep fakes, you know, seeing even today, again, going back to trending stories and like Kate Middleton, and there was this Photoshop fail, and then there's all sorts of stories that are spinning. And so as an investigator, because I know that's your training as well, do you have a method or protocol for how you consume news, how you advise people to read and critically examine all of the headlines that bombard us every day and be able to kind of set aside a filter that seems to be able to detect, I need to just set this aside, this is not true, or when we need to take a deeper look?
What you read and half of what you see. And as you point out with the story out of the UK with the image enhancement, you know, this whole artificial intelligence that's coming into play, we're going to have to change that to, you know, believe none of what you read and none of what you see. Everything is getting harder to differentiate. I think, you know, one of the things that we need to do, where do we start? You know, assuming that we're looking for the truth and not just looking for a validation of our worldview, which unfortunately a lot of us find ourselves in doing.
That's true.
You know, I'd say look for analysis from individuals and outlets who have a habit of upsetting both sides, both political sides. You know, if you really pay attention to who's saying what, you're going to find it's really easy to say, well, this guy always says the talking points on the right. This guy always says the talking points on the left. You can, I'm not going to say ignore everything they say, but if you're really trying to get to the truth of the matter, you've got to look for somebody who focuses on objectivity above all else. Neither side really owns all the facts, right? You got to challenge yourself a little bit. You know, there's no easy answer per se, but we've got to start by wanting the truth. Recognizing when we find ourselves in the middle of our echo chamber, right? Just restating and hearing these same things over and over again and not challenging ourselves to get to the bottom of the story. We all want our rage to be validated, but sometimes we confuse validation with truth. And that's not the case. So we've got to start by being skeptical. I think being a skeptic is a good first step. And then, you know, you try to build from there. It's not always easy to build off that skepticism and identify the truth after the fact. But if you're talking about the investigative mind, the investigator is going to start with being skeptical.
That is so key. We're speaking with Jeff Cortese, a decorated anti-fraud FBI agent, graduate of Franciscan University, today a nonpartisan law enforcement analyst. And when you talk about objectivity, that is where things get tricky. And again, we talk about this a lot because it used to be that in journalism or across the board, we could agree on what is knowable. There are some objective things, but now, whether it's biology or different things, the goalpost has moved. Well, maybe 2 + 2 doesn't equal 4. Maybe there aren't objective truths and this moral relativism that comes in. And that is why, again, the custody of the mind and the Catholic thought what is so crucial, because there is moral law, there's natural law, there's objectivity that isn't just our opinion. It's based on fact, science. It goes back through time and centuries and the greatest minds and scholars. And so that is really important. And then to filter from there, and like you said, the healthy skepticism, especially, and I'm just looking at the time, we have to take a break in a couple of minutes, but with the upcoming months, this is an election year. Do you believe that the election process is free of corruption in our country? Are you worried about the vulnerabilities in the system?
You know, there are a lot of topics that become more opaque when we insert politics into them. And unfortunately, politics is inserted into everything. This is one of those topics. It becomes incredibly difficult to have an honest conversation. We should be able to have a very honest discussion about how do we strike the right balance between voter accessibility and election security? At the end of the day, corruption is not something that you're ever going to fully get rid of. It requires a vigilant and constant fight. Election interference, election fraud, there are vulnerabilities, and the FBI and other law enforcement agencies are very well aware of those things. You involve technology into the mix. If you're using electronic equipment to vote and to tally votes, there are vulnerabilities that exist there. Vote buying is still a major issue across the country, mostly in rural areas and mostly impacting elderly people, minorities, and the poor. But there are plenty of people who are experiencing voter suppression through vote buying because they have needs that, are bigger than maybe their vote as far as they're concerned. And people know that and exploit that. So the vulnerabilities are always going to be there. And I think it's important to note that, while the right may be most emphatic about the vulnerabilities of election interference, election fraud, it's a well-documented history that both sides have expressed great concerns about election fraud and corruption. They just never expressed them at the same time, right? If you look at history, everyone gets upset about it at different times because there's a political strategy behind much of that motivation. But there are those of us who actually do care. Hey, is this being done right? Are we protected? And the truth of the matter is there's a good law enforcement presence out there, and they have to remain vigilant in order to ensure that we have honest and fair elections.
Well, and it's definitely, it's something to pray about, to watch. There's just so much there. And I think you so beautifully, clearly articulated that and clearly. Thank you so much, Jeff Cortese, with us, former field agent for the FBI, also a grad of Franciscan University of Steubenville, still lectures today. Today, a nonpartisan law enforcement analyst. Phone lines are open, by the way, if you want to join the conversation, 1-888-914-9149. That's 1-888-914-9149. There's a new article that looks at recruiting challenges, low morale, high stress among law enforcement officers. So when we come back, we'll take a look at that article, see if we can touch also on the border, because that was part of Jeff's expertise as well, get some insights and how we can strengthen our communities and also improve the landscape of law enforcement. That more to come when we come back. Stay with us here on the Cale Clark Show, back after the break.
This is the Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Jeff Cortese is a decorated anti-fraud FBI agent, former agent, SWAT team, graduate of Franciscan University today, a nonpartisan law enforcement analyst, and also the author of the book, Public Corruption in the United States, Analysis of a Destructive Phenomenon. So much to get into. And it's Brooke Taylor in for Cale. By the way, happy anniversary to Cale and his beautiful bride as they celebrate their wedding anniversary today. If you could say a prayer for he and his family for many blessed years. And we also are 1 week away from the Feast of St. Joseph, St. Joseph the Worker. So looking at the foster father of our Lord under different titles, Terror of Demons. And that was really kind of a theme with our guest, Jeff Cortese, as we're talking about truth, virtue, being on guard against corruption, what to look for. And Jeff, I wanted to ask you also, because this is your expertise and your deep experience with, you talked about the Southwest border violence there and any evaluation that you might have of what's going on at the border and how we might restore order.
Well, Boy, this is another one of those really inflammatory conversations that doesn't need to be and shouldn't be.
Right.
There are real life, real world implications to having an open border to not knowing who's coming into your country. I will say this. I can tell you this much. This is not inside baseball. You can go online and go to the FBI website and find the same information. But the FBI takes very seriously the threat at the border because of the national security implications of it. They're aware of the threat to the nation. When unknown individuals cross the border into the United States, they get it. Whether it's drug smugglers, human traffickers, terrorists, weapons of mass destruction, these are all major concerns for the FBI. They have over 20 border corruption task forces. The FBI doesn't work immigration, but they do work corruption and border corruption. And they have over 20 in the country partnering with state, local, and other federal law enforcement agencies to address corruption because they know that vulnerability at the border is a major national security risk. So, I mean, I think we need to level set the field by at least, you know, stating that much. This is a real threat. It's a real issue. We need to be aware of it. As far as, you know, how to address it, you know, some of that's going to be outside the, you know, we need to identify the people coming into the country to the extent that we can.
Right.
You know, this is a Catholic radio station. We're Catholics. We understand the challenges that people who are responsible for raising families in other countries, look at Haiti, for example, what's going on there, the violence, and I mean, some horrific stuff going on, right? Yeah. I completely understand anybody who would grab their family and try to get into the U.S. I get it. I understand that. And so, I mean, we should acknowledge and recognize how real some of that is for them. At the same time, people who could be coming in could be a threat to those of us who are in the country. So you have to balance that stuff out. Step one is to know who's coming.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave the politics to the politicians and all that other stuff. But as far as from a national security perspective, if you don't know who's coming in, you can't really fully understand or identify or prevent certain threats that may exist.
But it's helpful to know, just as you mentioned, there are 20 agencies that are not agencies, but within the FBI, right? So that's helpful and good. And, you know, again, one of those things that for the average civilian, I think is very difficult because you just feel helpless about so many of these issues. But knowledge is so important, and to get the right knowledge and objectively true knowledge is where we're seeking. And to that point, I want to take Dee Dee. She is on the line from Phoenix. She's calling from Arizona with a question about that objectivity. How do we develop objectivity? Hi, Dee Dee. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Hi. My question is for Mr. Cortese. You mentioned the importance of wanting the truth and searching for the truth, and also the importance of objectivity, remaining objective. Could you expand on how does one develop objectivity given how we're constantly being, you know what I'm talking about?
I do. It's incredibly difficult. I wish there was a silver bullet that I can hand to you. I think it starts, in all honesty, I think a big part of it starts in just wanting to be a objective, just wanting that truth. I think instinctively we tend to immediately latch on to any idea that confirms what I already believe without challenging it. Without really even listening to what the opposition might say. I mean, truly listening to it. I'm not talking about political opposition, but, you know, if you've got political voices who beat a drum that immediately gives you confirmation that you're believing the right thing, then, you know, maybe we need to challenge ourselves a little bit more. It's not, like I said, a real easy answer. But it does start by, you know, maybe not assuming that if somebody's repeating what I already think, then that must be the truth. It's going to differ. You sometimes have to find your subject matter experts. I can't possibly pretend to think that a Joe Citizen could understand the inner workings of the FBI. Even if they do their own research, it could be incredibly difficult to find that objective truth in there if there's a debate about FBI activity or whatever. So you have to try to find, to the extent that you can, those subject matter experts that you can put a little faith into. And like I said, you could probably start by people who have a tendency of to upset both sides.
Yeah, that's a good, that's a good, you know what I'm just thinking about though, Jeff, is with COVID, and I'm not in any way coming on any, I'm just saying that at the time all we could do was go on, well, this doctor, this expert, and then they found, well, they might be getting paid by this lobbyist group or whatever to say something. And it's so hard because this is the same thing with some of the transgender ideology. There might be experts who are saying this is fine. This is gender affirming care. You know, there are certain words, like trigger words that you use when you say, you know what? I don't know if this is actually an objective source here, because it's just the way it's become so polarized. And I think developing a Catholic ethic, of course, virtue, which teaches us prudence and justice, all of these things, I think helps us form our conscience, right? So that we can identify when there is moral law and natural law that are being followed. Because if someone is an expert, but they're also advocating for the destruction of the human life, then you know, this is not passing my meter here, right?
I think that's a beautiful point, and I think that is one of the great things that we have going in our favor, is we've got the foundation of the faith as a North Star for us,
yeah,
that gives us
good.
A leg up on everyone else, particularly on matters of morality.
And thank you for that question, Dee Dee. That was an excellent question. In the few minutes that we have left, Jeff, I just wanted to ask you about the morale with the law enforcement. There was an article that I was just reading, I don't know if it was Police Times. I had the source pulled up, but I can't find it now. And just talking about retention, recruitment, morale, severe stress for law enforcement, and what we as citizens might be able to do to help with the restoration of gratitude in supporting our good police officers and encouraging the positive aspects. What do you see and what might be able to do to help?
Yeah, you don't have to look very far to see that there's a morale issue or a numbers issue in law enforcement. They're having trouble filling the vacancies. Part of that is self-inflicted by law enforcement. Part of it is the byproduct of race baiters and those who like to stir the pot, so to speak, with false information. I think law enforcement has ownership in affecting change through transparency to the extent that they can without jeopardizing investigations. They need to be more open. People want to understand what's going on in law enforcement. From a community standpoint, I would just, again, this is one of those, what can you do except hold them accountable? You know, it's law enforcement's responsibility to build the trust. You know, important not to believe everything we hear at first blush when somebody is shot in the streets, you know, but it's law enforcement's responsibility to build the relationships with the communities. And those communities just need to hold out faith that it's going to, you know, that law enforcement's going to do what needs to be done.
Yes, and continue to pray, St. Michael, and cover all of us. Thank you so much, Jeff Cortese. And we will connect to your website, your information. It's Brooke Taylor in for Kale. Wish him happy anniversary. It's his anniversary today. God bless you. Thanks to Jim and my guest, Aaron Franco, today. Trending with Timory is up next. God bless you.